Welcome, folks, to the A Minute to Midnight show, and I'm Tony, and I'm calling, talking from New Zealand, and I've got a couple of guys today I'm talking to on the line that are in America. I've had them on the show before, Doug Woodward and Gary Huffman. I always enjoy talking to these two guys, and I'm sure we're going to go in a lot of different directions in this show. It'll be a real interesting discussion, so welcome, guys.
Hey, great to be with you.
Thank you, Tony. Good to be here.
Yep, it's been a wee while since we've done a show together, so it certainly feels like it's the right time to be doing it. So there's a lot going on, of course.
Oh, yeah, always, but especially the last couple of weeks. Woo.
Yeah.
Hard to keep up with it all.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, look, Gary, I want to go to you first. You know, we've got the Brexit thing coming up 29th of March, I think it is, and I'm wondering if it could be maybe an excuse for crashing the economy in Europe and maybe blaming Brexit for it. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on it.
Just looking at, there was an article that I was reading today, Brandon Smith on Alt Market, and I think I tried to post it on your Minute to Midnight Facebook page about five times today when Facebook was crashed, and then it finally posted miraculously. But did you see that, Tony?
I have actually read it, but yeah, my Facebook was still crashing. Actually, even just as I'm come on to talk to you, half of it still wasn't working for me. So, but yes, I have actually read that article, and Brandon Smith's articles are always good value.
Right. Yeah. So I don't remember if he says anything about Brexit, but he basically just says, you know, they're getting ready for a global economic reset and blame it on populism and conservatism.
And Brexit would fit in with that.
Oh, yeah. Right. And then, of course, he mentions the IMF and how they've been talking about blockchain technology and that's going to be part of the new reset. So I'm sure the Brexit will influence all of this too. So
yeah,
as Brexit itself, I don't have a lot to say about that.
It does seem like that Theresa May, I was just going to say, seems like Theresa May is just absolutely struggling to come up with any way forward, that it just doesn't look like it's going to get resolved. And that it's going to, in effect, sort of default back to having to do another referendum or, and as we say in the States, drop back and punt.
and Tony, now I'm sorry, I forgot, but here's a little blurb in that article. He says, in terms of the Brexit, I still predict that there will be a no deal event and that this is by design. So, and then he says the Brexit deal with the EU is slated to be decided in the next few weeks, and a no-deal outcome be a perfect excuse for a major financial crisis in Europe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you're right.
That kind of seems like that's my take on it as well. Is that it's headed into a default, no decision, you know, which will be a decision, but I'm not sure that it will lead to economic chaos, but it probably will lead to another change of government in the UK.
It's certainly going to be something to watch closely anyway.
Well, the economy all over the world is in big trouble. I mean, every other day, Michael Snyder writes a good article about that, you know, 12 reasons and all this kind of stuff. And
sure.
So, you know, it only takes a spark to burn the whole thing down, I think.
And
this might be the
eventually I think the globalist goal is always has been to crash it when they're ready, because they want a centralized monetary system and, of course, more control over everything than what they currently have. I think that's the end goal, you know, the IMF and the Bank of International Settlements and World Bank and so on will be, you know, where they try to centralize power ultimately, because power is in money, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it certainly seems to be. And you know, whether or not the Federal Reserve in the States is going to go along and comply. I watched an episode on our 60 Minutes magazine, which I think you guys have. I know Australia has a 60 Minutes.
Yeah, we
have. I don't know if you get that as well. So
yeah,
but anyway, they were doing the interview and the new Federal Reserve guy and it sounds like that things are relatively stable in the States with inflation just slightly over 2%. Economic growth is just slightly going to be under 3% GDP growth in the States. And so all of that sounds very stable, very peaceful. But the reality, of course, is that we keep increasing in the States a budget deficit of $1 trillion a year, adding to the into the national debt. And so we're looking at, you know, $25 trillion here in another 2 to 3 years. And it just seems like that can't go on forever.
No.
And the personal debt in the United States is credit card debt is huge right now, too.
Yep. And automobile loans is the other thing that's they're talking about, that so many people are behind on their auto loans. So those are kind of the key parameters right now that's guiding the finances in the States.
Yeah. It's interesting too, because before Trump was in power, he was talking about how we need to knock down the $18 trillion debt. Now it's $22 trillion and something,
right,
and growing constantly. So, yes,
right. Yeah, it was. I heard. I think it was yesterday. I heard that yes, they're promising a balanced budget, like in 15 years.
Well, maybe that's what he meant by build that wall. Maybe he's building a wall of debt.
I don't know. It certainly does is fact very high, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And Gary, you mentioned blockchain. Have you any thoughts on that? I know we've talked about AC chain in the past. What are your thoughts on it all?
Well, first of all, I was disappointed that was it Lynette Zhang? You guys didn't say anything about AC Chain last time you had her on, and so maybe there just wasn't anything to say. And honestly, there hasn't been anything new from AC Chain, and they were supposed to come out with a new white paper last fall, and that never happened. So I just been waiting for that. But I started looking at a YouTube channel, Adapt 2030. I don't know if you guys have heard of that.
I have not.
No. And the guy's name is David Dubine, and he either lived in China for a long time, or he lives there now. I'm not sure which, or he's there off and on. And he knows Chinese, so when he's doing a video, he can sound very Chinese, which is kind of funny. But
funny how that happens.
Yeah, when there's two videos that he's got that came out in 2017, which is when we all kind of discovered AC Chain and that whole thing, and Lynette Zhang was talking about it. And here's just a couple things out of his description from his YouTube articles. And actually, they're both the same. One just goes on farther and talks about digitizing assets, you know, and then, I'm just going to read a couple things here. The name of this one video is called Timeline for Global Cryptocurrency Acceptance, Digitizing Commodities and Mini Ice Age Crop Losses. So his main thing is about the mini ice age, the grand solar minimum that he is talking about is coming, and that we're into it right now, really. That's what he says. But 2030 is, I think, supposed to be the peak of that. And I've seen other articles by other people saying the same thing. So it seems like it may just be a thing. I don't know if you guys have heard anybody talking about the grand solar minimum.
Yeah.
So
only a little bit. It does sound like it's sort of a respite from the global climate brouhaha.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
You know, it's continuous.
Well, and you know, you realize that no matter what it is, they're going to blame it on you and me and our SUVs anyway. So
well, and Donald Trump, of course, too.
Donald Trump, yeah, because he doesn't care about climate change. Yeah, right.
That's right.
But he says, and this documentary is covers the method to internationalize and digitize all property, commodities, labor, and assets onto China's ACC blockchain and controlled through China's quantum network. So then he goes on to talk about using the blockchain to deliver commodities, you know, all over the world, basically, and that's why they're digitizing. They're starting with basically agricultural commodities, digitizing all those so that they can begin making the transactions over the blockchain, you know, through governments, individuals, whatever. And
it's really another means of control, isn't it?
Right.
You know, that's that, you know, we talk about the issue of privacy rights and all that. And that's, of course, has been a big theme. But it seems like the whole blockchain thing is just another mechanism to gain control over everyone in the world.
It is, you know, and people are that are all excited about it think, well, this is decentralization, so it's going to be much better for us. You know, it's out of the government's hands. But this right. is the point that he makes in the video. He doesn't really say it in this description, but is that the Chinese government is definitely involved. I mean, him living in China, he knows how they work. And he said that they wouldn't be allowing this to be happening in China without being involved. So they're involved behind the scenes is what he feels. And they don't really want people to know it's really a government project, you know. And so I think that's one reason we haven't seen much from them, because it kind of went a little bit off the radar to just continue digitizing everything and working on the whole process so that everything can be moved on the blockchain, just and including you and me, you know, because we're
assets. Is it in part because the shift of sort of innovation has it's not happening in the States, it's happening in China? You know, is that part of the reason why it's gone kind of quiet for us lately?
Well, that could very well be. And, you know, they're because of their quantum network, I think that they may have a better handle on that right now. And they've got that satellite quantum network.
Oh, yeah. Being able to use quantum communications. Yeah.
Things over the blockchain instantaneously all over the world using their quantum network. Right. So that's one reason. And then the other thing is they know when the mini ice age really gets in full swing, they're going to have a lot of trouble and they're going to need agricultural products from all over the world too. So that's one thing they're getting ready for, is to be able to do that. Anyway, that's kind of David Dubine's take on that, and I think he sounds like he knows what he's talking about. He went through the whole deal of where they were digitizing a certain kind of tea, and they made a cryptocurrency for the tea, you know, and that was kind of one of their first trials on that. But anyway, pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. As you were talking about that, I started thinking about something I've read a few times lately about, I think, RAND Corporation doing simulations of a world war, a nuclear war and so on, between America and Russia and China, and constantly the USA loses in all of the scenarios that they come up with for a war. Have you guys seen that at all?
I haven't seen that. I wrote that scenario 3 or 4 years ago, one of my books, and never changed my mind. I hadn't seen that. No, actually, I had heard about it. I didn't recall that it was the RAND Corporation that did that, although that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So you have written books on this subject. You've actually done a new book too, haven't you?
Yeah, I've done. I did a book on. I'll just mention the ones on the Russia thing. I did a small book. Is Russia destined to nuke the United States? And I did a kind of an analysis of it. It was about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's 3 years ago, and I was looking at the fact that the Russians had advanced their strategic nuclear weapons to where they were superior to what the U.S. had. And while the U.S. holds a decisive advantage in conventional you know, air and sea based weapon systems that, in terms of the theaters of interest, such as Eastern Europe and the Middle East, that the Russians have a, you know, a decided advantage. And that in terms of nuclear weapons, that the Russians have both offensively and defensively have a an enormous advantage. I was kind of a minor contributor to a book called The New Tactics of Global War by Benjamin Baruch and Jeffrey Nyquist. And for those people that are interested in digging into this, this is a, it's a good historical analysis of what's happened to bring us to this point. It is, Jeff Nyquist is a, he is a true expert and has been a consultant, to the military, to the State Department and others, on the subject of, relations, and the issues with Russia as a strategic enemy. And so we talked about that. And again, in that same book, we also pointed out that Russia has a significant advantage in virtually every aspect of the of nuclear warfare, both offensive, defensive, land based. Probably we have, the U.S. has an advantage in submarine based missiles, but because of some of the technologies that Russia has now, they're able to detect where our subs are. And so the fact that they can launch a nuclear missile into the water within, I think it's something like an 18 kilometer, if it's within 18 kilometers of where the U.S. sub is, it would knock it out. So it would be a significant advancement in depth charges, you might say. So the Russians could clean our clock. And of course, I've been saying that that's an area that I worry about, because we keep poking the bear in the eye, especially with all this Trump Russia collusion stuff. So anyway, so that's been something that I have written about and talked about quite a bit. But yeah, I have written a new book called Rebooting the Bible, and it's really dealing with the issue of the sort of rediscovering the Septuagint as the Bible of the early church. And the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew. And the argument I make, there's a couple arguments. One is that it's a more accurate rendering of what was actually said in the original Hebrew, because it's much, much closer to the source. And because the argument that I advance is that the Jewish rabbis at the end of the first century, three decades after the temple was destroyed, that the Jewish rabbis actually began to alter, literally corrupt messianic prophecies in the Hebrew Masoretic text, and in order to obscure the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. And this is actually something that the church fathers, Justin Martyr, Augustine, Irenaeus, and others talked about. It's something that we had lost track of, really, because of Protestants. We hadn't really paid attention to the Septuagint all that much. But as one digs into it, you discover that there's a dramatic difference in the chronology of the Old Testament, and that that the church fathers and even a dozen significant scholars after the Reformation basically said that the Septuagint's chronology is the biblical chronology, and it's about 1,600 years longer. In other words, instead of 4,004 BC per Bishop James Usher, it's more like 5,600 BC in terms of what the original Septuagint and the original Hebrew actually, what Moses wrote, if you will, what it tells us. So it's a controversial book.
So how is that? Is that provable? You know, or is it just theory?
No. It's provable in terms of looking through the Bible, and it's provable in terms of going through all of the material in the Bible, specifically looking at the chronologies in Genesis 5 and 11. The changes that were made by going and comparing texts that were created prior to the Christian church, including or at concurrent with, like Josephus. But the if you look at some of the ancient records, it verifies that the Septuagint's chronology is, in fact, more accurate. And it's what the church fathers for the first three centuries of the Christian church, what they confirmed, And again, there's been recent articles. The last 10 years, there have been a number of articles by various evangelical scholars basically arguing that the Septuagint chronology is the chronology that the church has upheld historically, and it's something that we should return to.
What's different in the chronology, though? I mean, like, I'm thinking, what specifically are you talking about?
Let me see if I can explain this. In the two chronologies, Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, you have each of the patriarchs. So from Genesis 5, you have Adam down to basically to Noah, right? And then in the second chronology, it's really a genealogy slash chronology. In chapter 11, you have really Noah and Seth down to Abraham. What you see in six or seven of the patriarchs in each of those different lists is you see 100 years subtracted from the time that the patriarch, how old they were when their child of promise was born. So, for instance, when Adam, when Seth was born to Adam, the chronology in the Masoretic text, what we have in the King James, is 100 years less than what it is in the Septuagint. And you see that in six of the other patriarchs as well. You see the same thing in six or seven of the patriarchs after the flood. And the reason that this was done, which has been argued by a number of folks, including even some of the Jewish scholars, is that the rabbis were at that time, in the first century, the belief was that the Messiah was going to come in the sixth millennium. And so sometime after year 5000, the Messiah was going to come. And so the rabbis attempted, and they did successfully, change the chronology in Genesis 5 and 11. They eliminated, it's the total of about 1,386 years is actually what it calculates out to. So they brought down, in effect, instead of Christ coming, Christ actually came in about the year 55 or 5600 from Adam and Eve. And of course, Usher and the King James calculates 4004 BC. But the explanation is that the reason the rabbis did that is they wanted to disqualify Jesus as the Messiah. You had them doing the same thing with the 70 weeks of Daniel. In what is known, the Jewish calendar is based upon the Seder Olam Rabbah. And it was done by a disciple of Rabbi Akiva named Yosef ben Halafta, Halafta. That's correct. And I have to visualize it and then pronounce it. He wrote the Jewish calendar was created around 160 A.D. And of course, today the Jewish date is 5779. And what happened was that they took out about eight of the Persian kings. They cut them out of the Jewish chronology, and it dropped about 165 years in the length of the reigns of the Persian kings. So after Cyrus, you had the Xerxes and the Artaxerxes and so forth, and Darius, and there's like 14 or so kings, but they lost about eight of the kings. And so they took out about another 165 years. So when you add all these things together, plus there's other calculations I go through and look at the length of the judges, the period of the judges, the actual when did the kingdom split, the North Kingdom and Northern and Southern Kingdom split, and do research on all of those things to point out that the Exodus occurred about 200 years earlier than the conservative view. The conservative view is that the Exodus occurred in about 1450 BC, And the calculations that I have done, and also the guys, Timothy Mahoney, David Rawl, who's his Egyptologist, they calculated the same thing, but they wouldn't press it too hard in their film Patterns of Evidence. I don't know if you saw that or not, but it's a great film, Patterns of Evidence. And so I calculate that the Exodus was around 1628 is the specific date I come up with for a variety of reasons. The conservative view is 1450, and the liberal view is 1250. And so I argue that it's much earlier. So you have to factor all those things in. Once you know the Exodus date, you can move precisely back to the birth of Abraham. Part of this gets into the Septuagint and how long the Israelites were actually captives or slaves in Egypt. And the tradition says 400 years. The actual number, I believe, was 100 years. They were in Canaan and in Egypt for 430 years in total, but the amount of time that they were actually slaves in Egypt was only 100 years. And some other things. For instance, it appears that Abraham was born exactly 500 years before the Exodus occurred. And then therefore Isaac 100 years, or excuse me, 400 years before the Exodus occurred. Once you know Abraham's date, then you can go all the way back to Adam based upon the chronologies, the genealogies of Genesis 5 and 11. So you assemble all that together, which is what I do. I get into Egyptology and the Mesopotamian stuff as well in the book, and basically argue that the chronology of the Old Testament, that Adam and Eve were actually created by God around 5600 BC, and that is very close to what most of the church fathers argued as well, between 5400 and 5600 BC.
So,
wow.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, okay. What are the arguments against what you're saying? Like, why are people saying, no, we believe the Masoretic text rather than the Septuagint is the one we should right. be going by?
Well, there's a whole King James only crowd. They have a many, many arguments, which, of course, I'm dealing with now because I'm getting a lot of pushback from those folks. As soon as you say the Septuagint has a more accurate messianic set of messianic prophecies and chronology, then they're naturally going to react because that says that they're, you know, that the Masoretic text and the King James is therefore not accurate. And but the arguments against the chronology is, is that, well, why would the Jews, change their chronology? I mean, this is their sacred book, and they would say that, well, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, come on, that Adam waited till he was 230 years old before he had Seth. Well, I mean, is that as any more illogical than 130? It's like, it's completely outside of the realm of what we experience. So, so they'll say some things like that, but if you go in and you look at, for instance, the Samaritan Pentateuch, you look at the Josephus I mentioned, there's another book called the Book of Biblical Antiquities, which was a Latin book, which is Liber Biblica Antiquitatum or something like that in Latin. But all of these really use the chronology of the Septuagint. The Septuagint, the chronology of the Masoretic never really existed in history until after the first century AD, because it was created by the rabbis. And so there's no historical record of it occurring before then. And then you've got very, very few. For instance, the Vulgate could be an argument against it. Jerome, when he wrote the Vulgate, which was around 400 AD, he based the Vulgate predominantly upon the Hebrew, not the Septuagint, because he had friends that were Hebrews, and they said, well, of course, the Hebrew is superior to the Greek Septuagint because it's just a translation of the Hebrew. So there was that point. Origen had already tried to create a harmonization of the various Greek versions after Rabbi Akiva and company created a new Hebrew version around 100 AD. There were three new Greek versions that were created by Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion. And they were all created based upon the new Hebrew, updated and I think corrupted, Vorlag, V-O-R-L-A-G-E, which is the original from which copies were made. And it they do not agree with the old Greek, the Septuagint that was written in or translated in Alexandria, Egypt, around 280, 285 B.C. That's when the Pentateuch, the first five books, were translated. All of the books, all the prophets and the histories were translated probably by 200 B.C. But nevertheless, so you've got – those are some of the major arguments that you know, some say, well, it's just that the Hebrews came up with these dates because they were envious of the ancient Egypt history, and so they were trying to push their history back earlier. So you have some of those things, which none of those really hold water. But so the folks that are studying this, though, and as I said, there's a number of articles that have been written recently by highly regarded evangelical scholars, and you know, there's a strong case being built nowadays for the chronology of the Septuagint.
Have you got any thoughts on it, Gary?
Well, I just have a very important question, Doug.
Okay.
Do I need to learn Greek?
Well, you needed to anyway because of the New Testament, right?
Well, I know. So, for instance, the Apostle Paul used the Septuagint, mostly quoted from the Septuagint, right?
Correct. I actually did an analysis last night because I had seen a presentation by what I would consider to be a demagogue preacher here in the States. And he made statements like that. The Septuagint doesn't quote any of the Pentateuch. It only quotes the prophets. It actually does these quotations 100 and 200 years after the New Testament. And so I kind of, you know, did some analysis. And it turns out that there's about 230 passages in the Septuagint that are expressly quoted in the New Testament,
right.
And 30% of them are from the Pentateuch, roughly 40% from the prophets, and this the ratio is, you know, very heavily Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and the Psalms, and that's the same ratio you see. That's where the sprinkling of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's predominantly the three books that are in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And those are the ones, of course, that are very heavy in terms of messianic prophecy and, you know, and the law, the purpose of the law. So and the history of the early Hebrews. So so it kind of makes sense.
So, Doug,
yes.
So what version should I be reading the Septuagint, or what version? what version of the Bible, then, after doing this study, do you recommend?
Well, okay, if you,
I know the different ones are.
I have read two different versions of the Septuagint. There's one that's done by the Eastern Orthodox Church, and I'm getting to know a number of the folks in the Eastern Orthodox Church, as you might imagine, because for them, the Septuagint has always been their Bible. They never used anything else. Mm-hmm. But so there's one by the Eastern Orthodox. The one that I find to be the most scholarly is a book called it's Netz for New English Translation of the Septuagint, and it is published by Oxford, and it's excellent. Both these came out around 2007, and they were created from work that had been done on the Septuagint in Germany for a number of decades. And so now in terms of traditional versions, the English Standard Version, the ESV, is probably the best version. It is still based on the Masoretic, but it has the variations. The variants are noted in the margins or in footnotes, mm-hmm. Both for the Septuagint and for the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay. And so that's very helpful. I have particularly a Bible that is the ESV Archaeology Bible, and it's outstanding because it really does get into the archaeological issues, maps, and various other things that are pertinent. So it really brings it down to a much more understandable historical level by that Bible does, from my standpoint. So it's the Bible I recommend.
So basically, were there any real versions available of Septuagint translations in the last, you know, until recently, or are you saying that we have not had an accurate Bible in the hands of English speaking people or whatever for the last 500 years?
Yeah, no, there was Breton's, B-R-E-T-T-O-N, I believe it is, Breton's version, and there's a prior one to that. The one that was relatively, well, I'd say it was more modern was around 1800. There was an English version that was done, and then there was, and then Breton's version was done around 1860, 1870, and it's kind of the standard even today. You know, that's Tom Horn has, you know, sent out he's published a version of the Septuagint, and it's Breton's version because it's public domain now. And so it's been around for 160 years. And so that really is, those are the two that have been around for a long time. But the, you know, prior to that, you really didn't have anything but, for the most part, a Greek Septuagint, and a lot of the King James only people will say that the Septuagint played no role in the King James. That's not true. The King James scholars did look at the Septuagint. There's a couple of very important points, a couple of very famous verses, Isaiah 7:14. You know, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. the Masoretic and the Hebrew says a young woman. But the scholars knew well enough, although they didn't change everything to correspond to the Septuagint, they did change that verse. They went back with virgin. And the other thing they changed, which was interesting, is in Psalm 22. In Psalm 22, we probably remember the fact that David is prophesying about the, you know, the Messiah. You know, that it says in the Psalm 22, they pierced my hands and my feet. Well, in the Masoretic, it says, my hands are like lions. And so it's like, oh, but if you go back to the Septuagint, what does it say? The Septuagint says, they pierced my hands and my feet. Mm-hmm. And so what I do in the book is I point out a lot of these areas. One of the big theme you see is the Gentiles. You see that a lot of the verses where it talks about the Messiah coming to be the ruler of the Gentiles, the Gentiles shall trust in the Messiah and so forth. You see these being changed in the Masoretic. So they downplay the importance of the Messiah to the Gentiles, and they also downplay some of the deity aspects of the Messiah as well, in terms of his being at the beginning of the world, being, you know, from the foundation of the world and so forth. They change that. They omit phrases such as the phrase about in Isaiah 66 where Christ gets up and reads, you know, from the scroll from Isaiah about, you know, that he's there to preach to the poor and to help recover the sight to the blind. Well, in the Masoretic, they omit that phrase, recover, you know, the sight to the blind is not in there. And that's not hard to figure out that the Pharisees are going to remember John 9 and the incident of Jesus healing the man born blind. And so that's been taken out of the Masoretic text. It's not in the Hebrew Bible. And so you see other things. The worship, the angels worship the Messiah, that's not in the Masoretic text. That's quoted by Paul in the book of Hebrews. You see a lot of these a lot of verses in the book of Hebrews that are, you know, the real argument is if you just look at the New Testament quotation of the Old Testament and you go back and you look, you'll see that in many cases, the New Testament, quoting the old, the verses are different. And, you know, as I was talking to, Dr. Michael Lake last night did a radio show with him, we were talking about this and he said, you know, I used to just think those were translation differences, but he said, what you're pointing out is it's far more than translation differences. They were changing the nouns and the verbs and everything. They were changing the text. And I said, yeah, that's very evident. When you see all of this together, you know, you're not just picking up one or two things, but you're looking at two dozen or three dozen of these verses, you're going to see that there were changes that were being made. And that, like I said, that's exactly what Justin Martyr said in his dialogue, The Trifo, which was only about 40 or 50 years after the rabbis made these changes. He pointed out that they were corrupting the scriptures because they were trying to keep Jews from converting to Christianity.
That's really interesting. Now, I'm just thinking I'm sure the people who listen to this that are young Christians and don't really know too much.
Sure.
It's like I'm thinking, people need to realize that the Old Testament was written in Hebrew and the New Testament was probably not written in Hebrew ever, was it? It was written in Greek from the word go.
It was written in Greek. That's correct.
Yep.
So it was providential that you had an Old Testament that was in Greek that the writers of the New Testament could readily use. So that you had a universally understood language that they could use for evangelism purposes.
So when was the Septuagint first translated into Greek?
Yeah, so the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, were translated about 285 BC at the order of Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, and it was done in part to create a Greek Bible for the great library in Alexandria. And it was also done in part because about a fourth of the population of Alexandria was Jewish. And the Jews, by the way, at that time throughout the world didn't speak Hebrew anymore. They spoke Greek because of Alexander the Great, that he had conquered the world around 330 BC. And he forced everybody to learn to speak Greek and to write Greek.
Interesting.
So the rest of the Hebrew books were probably completed around 200 BC. You had some Greek original books like the Maccabees, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Maccabees, that were written originally in Greek, and those were written and not completed until about 130, 140 BC, because those events didn't happen until about 170 BC. And then you have some other books that are known as poetic books that are there that were not included in, you know, here's the funny thing is that the King James only folks want to say, well, you know, the Apocrypha was spurious and uninspired. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why the King James, you know, is God's word. Well, for the first 100 years when the King James was published, it was published with the Apocrypha. So you can't really argue that.
Yeah, right.
So
King James is it then?
Yeah, well, it's the one they argue for is the 1611 authorized version. And that itself is a whole new thing. I'm writing articles now and posting blogs and of course getting hammered by the King James only people because they're convinced that I have it doubled now.
So Doug, I think this is probably something Tony's wondering about, trying to get at. Yeah. Can we still read our King James Bible? I actually love to read the King James Bible too.
Yes, yes. Well, first off, the New Testament is fine. Why is the New Testament fine? Because it quotes from the Septuagint. In 90% of the cases, it's quoting from the Septuagint.
The rabbis have an influence on that.
They didn't have any influence on that. Ironically, the rabbis, the reason they wanted to make the change was by the end of the first century, the Septuagint was already being called the Christian's Bible. And so that was one of the reasons why they wanted to create a revised Hebrew Bible that they were making changes to, of course. And so, so you've got that. Keep in mind that you're dealing with two primary areas where there are differences. One is the chronology, as I mentioned, Genesis 5 and 11. And then the other are in the messianic, many of the messianic prophecies. And so, when you're reading the Psalms or you're reading most of the Bible, certainly the history of the Bible, 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, 2nd Chronicles, you know, Ezra and all that, you're not going to have any problems. But it's really, if you're looking at the Psalms, Isaiah, and those two books are heavily messianic prophecy oriented, you're going to see some significant changes. And so you need to be apprised. But if you are looking at those Old Testament prophecies in the New Testament, you're not going to see a problem because they're quoting from the Septuagint.
Okay, so now what's the oldest surviving versions of both the Septuagint and the Masoretic text? How old are
Great question.
Yeah.
Great question. All right. So one of the ways that it's looked at is the number of codices. A codex or a codice is a book form of, an effect of the writing. Rather than a scroll, the book was called a codex or a codice. There are three codices for the Greek Old Testament and actually the whole Greek Bible, which is both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And they all date from the 3rd or 4th centuries. All right, so you have Vaticanus, and it was called Vaticanus because it was held in the Vatican, not because the Vatican wrote it, which is another thing that I heard in the uneducated guy that was talking about this stuff. You have Sinaiticus, which was discovered in the St. Catherine's Monastery at the Sinai, and that was in the 3rd century. And then you have Alexandrinus. And so these are known as A, B, and S, Codex A, Codex B, Codex S. There are three. All three of these codices then were written and are available, and they're in museums in Britain or whatever. And they're from 300, 350, 400 BC. And they were probably written in the scriptorium that was run by Athanasius in Alexandria, all right? So there's some arguments about whether they were written in Eusebius's scriptorium in Caesarea, but they probably weren't. They were probably done, or they were, copies of that. But again, you're dealing right at that same time frame as Athanasius, because Athanasius is 350, 370 BC. So he's still in charge of his scriptorium that wrote the probably Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus. So, so you probably got Athanasius's, blessing basically on those directly. Now you jump over and you say, okay, what about the Masoretic text? Well, the Masoretic text, it's a little confusing. The oldest codice that we have of the Masoretic text is from 1008 AD. So it's almost 700 years later. And it is Leningrad, Codex Leningradus. And it's also, by the way, now in the British Museum, because Lenin decided that he needed to raise some money. So he sold the codex that the Russian Orthodox Church had of the Masoretic text. He sold it to the UK, in about 1925 or 1930, something like that, for 100,000 British pounds. The actual, I have to stretch my memory here again. It was actually based, though, on a Masoretic version from the 9th century. So the closest complete Old Testament that we have is approximately 800 years after the Hebrew Masoretic text that was created by Akiba. Right now, others might say, "Well, it wasn't created by Akiba. Akiba merely copied it." Well, no. We know from the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there's differences in the Dead Sea Scrolls from Akiba's version versus from other Hebrew versions, that changes were made in the Hebrew, because other Hebrew in the Dead Sea Scrolls shows different textual families, as they're called. And so that's a pretty big deal. One of the things about Akiba, it's a number of the Jewish scholars say this, that Akiba and clearly intended to create a new Hebrew Bible and to destroy all of the other copies of any other Hebrew text families. So he wanted to destroy all of them because he only wanted his Bible to be the only Bible that the Hebrews would reference. What he didn't realize was these guys named the Essenes were storing copies of the Hebrew and the Septuagint in their caves at Qumran. And so his strategy was undone, you know, in 1947 when we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls.
So, okay, now the writers of the King James, the translators, I should say, rather than writers.
Yes.
They must have had access to both of these, the Masoretic and the Septuagint. What would have been their reason then for choosing the Masoretic as their main primary text?
And I cover this in the book. There were 47 scholars that were operating under the auspices of King James, and they used predominantly the Bishop's Bible, which had been completed roughly 50 years before the King James. There were several English Bibles. Actually, Queen Elizabeth had an authorized Bible as well. And then the Bishop's Bible was the sort of official Church of England Bible until the King James. And so they used that as their base text. They also used the Geneva Bible, but King James specified that they had to be careful not to use any of that Calvinistic Presbyterian type of church hierarchy because that conflicted with the Church of England. And he considered it, basically it was anti-monarch. But nevertheless, they used the Geneva Bible. They referred to the Vulgate, to the Latin Bible, which they all knew Latin. They did not use the Septuagint that much. I think that they understood the Greek. How well they understood Greek versus Latin, not clear. But they predominantly used the Masoretic at that time, and that was done that way because the Reformation had occurred almost exactly 100 years before, in 1517, and the Reformation decided that the Bible of the Protestant churches needed not to be the Catholic Bible. It needed not to be the Orthodox Bible, which were the Vulgate and the Septuagint, respectively. It needed to be the Hebrew Bible because they felt that it would be more authoritative if it was Hebrew, not realizing that they were actually bringing forward the corruptions of Rabbi Akiba into the Protestant Bibles. And that's what the Reformation did. You get into the whole issue of the Textus Receptus, the Greek Bible of Erasmus. Erasmus first published a Greek Bible in 1513, I believe it was, and then several editions afterwards. The actual received text was first published by a guy named Beza, B-E-Z-A, in like 1604. And the final received text that we know as the received text that actually said in Latin, it said is the, you know, received text was in 1633, which is, of course, 22 years after the King James was published, meaning that although the King James only crowd wishes to argue that the King James is based on the received text, and the received text is sacrosanct, it's perfect. Well, it wasn't based on that. It was based on something that had been done before by Erasmus and by a guy named Stephanus in 1550. So you had these different Greek versions. These are New Testament versions, all right? And so the New Testament was based upon these Greek versions that Erasmus had done and so forth. And that's where the first Bibles really, that's where the King James came from. Erasmus only had approximately six Greek manuscripts, and parts of his manuscripts he didn't have. For instance, the Book of Revelation, there were pieces missing, and so there's some errors that occur in the King James in the Book of Revelation that it's because Erasmus had incomplete manuscripts. Today, Erasmus had six manuscripts. Today, we have over 6,000 manuscripts. That's why the accuracy is much higher today than it was 400 years ago. But then you get into what's called the Byzantine text, the Alexandrian text, the majority text versus the minority text, and you go through all these things, and essentially at the end of the day, what you realize is that the oldest manuscripts are not the ones that the King James used. The King James used newer manuscripts that were more likely to be corrupted than the manuscripts that were that have been discovered that were earlier manuscripts that date back into the 3rd century and into the 2nd century. And there are differences in the text. Now, these are not like material differences in terms of the doctrines. I mean, we still believe in the Trinity, and that was still in these early documents. But there are differences in spelling, some in grammar, names, spelling of names, place names, things like that. And there are a few omissions, but mostly the changes are additions. They are scribal copyist inclusions, where they're including things that they wanted to clarify or they felt was appropriate to add into the text to make it more clear. And so that's how the text is in effect bigger or fatter now than it was originally, is because of these additions that were made by the scribes throughout the 1500 years of copying.
You got any questions, Gary? We're getting close to an hour, so we'll have to look at wrapping up, please.
Yeah. We have many more topics to cover.
Well, we're not going to be able to, unfortunately.
Yeah, we didn't even get to Mystery Babylon tonight, did we?
No.
Oh, so we will have to get together again. Well, I just want to say, and this is a statement and a question perhaps, but I think we have to say that God allowed this to happen for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's providence of God, and why would he do that? And in my mind, just thinking about it as you were talking, I think that he had some things that he wanted to reveal towards the end, end times, that were sort of hidden because of some of these things and maybe other things. And that's why the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947. That's why we have, you know, the Book of Enoch and some of these other books that are available now that weren't then. Is God is revealing some new things that, you know, I mean, it's not brand new, but it's supplementary to the Bible that we have. So I think he did it on purpose, and I think it was a good plan.
Yeah,
ultimately,
I agree, and it's intriguing, Tony. What I've run across is I'm talking with. On shows like last night with a couple of guys that are doctors of divinity, that all of this material is stuff they've never heard before. And frankly, a year and a half ago, I hadn't heard of it either. But I just kind of stumbled into it and started digging into the research. And wow, I was like blown away. I was going, well, this is significant, because some of these things are pretty significant in terms of the chronologies and the messianic stuff and the rabbinic conspiracy, and gosh, the church fathers were talking about these things, and we kind of just skipped past all that. We didn't know that was going on. It was there. We just weren't looking at it.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting, because I hadn't heard of this either until I'm talking to you today. So now, you guys better give your websites, and Doug, you can tell the name of the book and where people can get it.
Sure. You go first, Gary.
Okay. So my website is the-revealing.com. It's the website for Doug and Mai's book that we wrote together, and that's me. And I'm also on Facebook in a couple spots.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, you know, my major site is faith-happens.com. And you can also find me by just doing a search on doomsdaydoug.com, all one word. On Facebook, it's Facebook/ S as in Stephen, S Douglas with one S, Woodward. And then on Amazon, you can do a search for S Douglas Woodward. And I've done now 16 books. It's crazy. And the latest book, what we've been talking about, is Rebooting the Bible, Rebooting the Bible. You can tell I was an information technology guy by using that term rebooting. And it actually turns out it actually is appropriate, because we're rebooting back to the Septuagint. What Gary and I wrote together, The Revealing, that book is really dealing with the issue of glorification and what our life is going to be like after we have been translated in the rapture. And so it's a topic that's dealt with the New Testament, but it's not not popularly known, and so not commonly known. So we encourage people to read that. It'll give your spiritual life a lift.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we'll have to get back together and cover some other topics in the next few weeks again. So thanks, guys, for being on the show. The hour went super fast, but thank you.
It always does.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Thanks anyway.
Thank you for the opportunity. We always appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, folks, this show was actually recorded a few days ago, and I didn't get it out because I'd been focused on the tragedy shooting in New Zealand, the terrorist attack in Christchurch, which I've got to say I have some serious question marks around some of the official narratives there. It's looking a lot like a false flag to me, not a hoax. People really did die, but there are some aspects of it that, well, I say I have very big question marks around, but you just have to be very careful what you say in this day and age, and checking facts very, very closely before saying anything. So anyway, please visit aminutetomidnight.com and you'll find our shows there, and also a video I did on that shooting, and articles on the website. And we do run A Minute to Midnight by donations 100%, and we really appreciate people helping us out through donations, and you can do that on the website. Be much appreciated when people do help. All the music used in the shows is written, played, and recorded by me, and you can find some free music on the website as well. And we do have a community forum on the aminutetomidnight.com website, which we really do encourage people to join up to and to contribute to. Well, that's it for this show. We will catch you again in a few days' time. Have a great week. God bless. And this is Tony saying goodbye until the next time we catch up.